Greetings from the west coast of Sweden. This is Henrik Palmgren and you are listening to Red Ice Creations Radio. The website is redicecreations.com. That's R-E-D-I-C-E creations.com. Frequently updated news, links, resources, and of course a growing radio archive. We also have a member section where we have a lot of extended interviews with many of our guests. We also have films, articles, and other extra materials there for you. It's a very good resource for those of you who want to dive further into the many subjects that we highlight on this program. And today we're going to dive into the topics of entheogen, sacred ecology, and Gordon Wasson and his thesis on the origins of religion, and much more. We have John Lash with us on the line, and for those of you who are regular listeners, you know that we had John with us about 3 months ago now. We had a very interesting program back then talking about his book Not in His Image, Gnostic Vision, Sacred Ecology, and the Future of Belief. We talked very much about the archons, but not as much about sacred ecology, so this is what we'll kind of dive further into today. John's website that you need to take a look at is metahistory.org. That's an excellent and vast resource with tons of articles for you to explore further. Metahistory.org. Also take a look at his companion site, futureprimitive.org, where you can find podcasts and a lot of other material that goes alongside the material on metahistory. So let's say hi to our guest. Hi, John. It's a pleasure having you back on the program again.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Excellent. And great to have you back. I thought we'd begin this program to talk a little bit about Gordon Wasson and ethnomycology. For those who don't know, if you will, John, tell us a little bit of background on Gordon Wasson, if you will.
Well, Gordon Wasson was a strange man in the sense that he was a very conventional man. He was a banker who worked in New York, a banker and a financier. And he died, I think, in 1986. He was a very conventional man who dressed very much as businessmen do and so forth. And yet it turns out that this man, Gordon Wasson, is connected with probably the most revolutionary event that happened in the 20th century, at least one of the most revolutionary events, and that was the discovery of the mushroom cult in Mexico, the mushroom cult of the Mazatec Indians. And consequently, subsequent to that discovery was, the whole psychedelic revolution of the 60s really came about through this strange banker named Gordon Wasson.
That's interesting. And, I mean, I kind of have connected Gordon Wasson a little bit with the other man who wrote Sacred Mushroom and the Cross.
John Allegro.
John Allegro, thank you. Yeah, is there a connection between those two in any way?
There is the Wasson thesis on the origin of religion, and we'll discuss this, and I'll describe exactly what it is. It's a big phrase, but it's not exactly that complicated to describe. And John Allegro is someone who came along a little bit after Wasson, and his view is what I would call a kind of spin-off of the Wasson thesis. Mm-hmm. It has had three spin-offs. One of them was by John Allegro, The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Another spin-off from the Wasson thesis was by Professor Carl Ruck, who still is alive, and he teaches Greek at Boston University. And then, of course, there was Terence McKenna, who drew very deeply from the Wasson thesis and had his own particular spin-off. So since it was introduced in the early 1950s, several people have taken Wasson's idea and elaborated it in one way or another.
I see. And let's dive into it here then. The Wasson thesis on the origin of religion. Are we solely talking about Christianity here, or does this go way, way further back than that?
It goes back. We're not talking about the origin of religion in the sense of the building of the Temple of Solomon. We're not talking about the Ten Commandments or even the ancient Persian writings and the ancient writings of India that may have preceded the Bible. We're basically talking, the Watson thesis is really about the origin of the religious experience. What we need to understand when we approach Watson is that religion may be defined as a structure of teachings, of dogmas and doctrines, as well as an organization and a hierarchy. Typically, for instance, the Catholic religion consists of certain teachings.
Right.
It consists of a hierarchy of men who apply those teachings, and it consists of a vast organization of churches. All of this is religion. And then you can look at Hinduism or any other kind of religion in the same respect. The Watson thesis does not explain the origin of those religions as such. It explains the origin of humanity's first religious experience. And according to Watson, it's very simple. All religions began, all religions that later evolved on this planet to the form they have today, they all began from a visionary trance induced by the ingestion of certain psychoactive plants, particularly mushrooms.
And these mushrooms, we're talking about the ancient cults here in a way. Could these be found all over the world at this point, or is this restricted to one area on the planet?
Not really restricted to one area. Watson concentrated a lot on Russia and the Ural Mountains, and he concentrated on Siberian shamanism, and he concentrated on one particular mushroom called the Amanita muscaria, or fly agaric mushroom.
Right, right.
But then, strangely, there are some contradictions in Watson's work, and it doesn't always hang together. The actual mushroom ceremonies that he himself experienced were in Mexico.
Right.
And in that case, he used a different species. He used the psilocybe species, or the blue-staining magic mushrooms that are, of course, well-known around the world today. Those are the mushrooms that had been traditionally used by the Mazatec Indians in Oaxaca, the mountains of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the Watson thesis, the general thesis, developed, it became obvious that different species of mushrooms could have been used in these primordial rites.
Right. And because, I mean, South America is something, to me at least, that instantly comes to mind when talking about entheogens, and that has kind of been associated with it. But what you're saying here is that this is pretty much widespread across the globe then, right?
It certainly is. There are very few places on the Earth, except in the remote areas of Alaska, in the Arctic, where some kind of psychoactive plants do not grow. And so whether it be ayahuasca in Peru and the Amazon, whether it be the psilocybin mushrooms that grow all over the British Isles, whether it be Amanita, which grows in your area of the world as well, wherever there are fir forests. So there are many candidates. It's still under discussion which particular mushroom had inspired the first religious experience. In my view, I think it's logical to say that various kinds of mushrooms were involved, but the same religious experience came out of these different species.
And I mean, would you say at this point then that is because it's the same psychoactive substance in all of them? Is that correct?
Well, of course they have different properties, but primarily, for instance, Amanita muscaria has different properties than psilocybin mushrooms. I've been studying illuminated manuscripts and other things such as Roman and Greek art, which depict mushrooms in religious scenes. And I'm convinced from this evidence that the mushrooms that were most commonly used in these early religious rites were the blue-staining psilocybe mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are the ones that are most clearly depicted and frequently depicted in a lot of the artifacts. Secondly, the Amanita muscaria mushroom is also depicted. Everyone knows what that looks like. That's the Christmas tree mushroom.
Right, right.
The big red one with white spots.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there are problems with the Amanita muscaria because experimentation shows that its effects are very variable and inconsistent, whereas the religious and illuminating effects of the psilocybe mushrooms are much clearer and easily proven. So I'm inclined to follow that path in trying to prove the or demonstrate the Watson thesis.
Hmm. And I mean, so what would you say kind of have defined this? I mean, do you think that man back then basically stumbled across this in some way, and this then a consequence of that after ingesting it or otherwise profoundly changed man's perception of reality? Tell us a little bit about the background of what you think were going on back then.
Well, Watson claims, as I said, and I'll repeat it again because it is a simple concept, but a very far-reaching one. Before there were any religions as such, before there were priests, before there were churches, when we were living in the Paleolithic age and we were living in tribal situations, people ingested psychoactive mushrooms and went into a visionary trance and had religious experiences. They had illuminations. And from those illuminations, eventually what we call religion was developed. Now, you pose a very good question. I mean, did they just kind of stumble on these mushrooms, or how did this happen? I don't really have a view on that, but I think that the testimony of Albert Hofmann here would be quite relevant. You know, Albert Hofmann, who just died recently, he was 102 years old, was the Swiss chemist who discovered LSD, who made LSD and who discovered its properties.
Mm.
And as the story goes, in the 1940s, when he was working for Sandoz Labs in Basel, they had made several LSD compounds, and they were trying to find something to help women in childbirth, because LSD is synthesized from ergot, from a fungus of ergot, and that is known to have been used by midwives to help contractions. Well, anyway, it wasn't working out very well, and they had shelved, Hofmann had made these formulas, LSD in a powder form, and he had shelved them in his laboratory.
Mm.
And he explains how one day in 1947, when he was alone in his laboratory working, that he, 1943, excuse me, that he heard sort of LSD calling to him.
Mm.
He sort of heard the chemical or the spirit in that chemical calling to him. And as a result of that, he took down the compound from the shelf, and he began to manipulate it and got some accidentally on his fingers. And then he had the first LSD experience, and from then on, of course, it developed very rapidly. My guess would be that when our ancestors were out in nature, they were extremely observant of the natural world, and that they would have noticed certain plants and would have perhaps had a kind of reception to these psychoactive plants. Of course, they may have just eaten them accidentally. That's always possible because they are edible, and there they are sticking up out of the ground. But I also have a feeling that there was a communication between our species and nature that has always been present.
Yeah.
And that had something to do with us being called toward these plants and being drawn into the experiences that these plants offer us.
Right. And I mean, if we talk about Terence McKenna again, I mean, I know that he's spoken a lot about the fact that he thinks even that, things like language and art has kind of spawned out of this relationship almost with these various psychoactive substances. I don't know if that's something that you, you endorse at all or feel it's...
I do. Valid. I endorse that very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
Terence's spin-off on the Watson thesis was not merely, he didn't just accept the primary idea that our first visions of God and visions of divinity came through these psychoactive mushrooms. He accepted that totally. But he went further than Watson, and he said that probably our very brains and the circuitry of our neurological circuits that allows us to use language and to form symbols and create art was probably enhanced and amplified by these psychoactive plants.
Hmm.
And I totally endorse that view. I think there's a lot of sound reasoning in that.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. And I mean, if we, I don't know if it's too soon, but if we forward that, up to our age, so to speak, or the last 2,000 years, I mean, if these things have helped to spawn religion, what does that mean? Does that mean that it's a that this is a negative connotation, or is this a perverted way that has happened here, that those who are in control of a religion today have not really kind of absorbed the true message of this, but they've perverted it. What do you think, John?
Well, I think that if we're going to talk about the Watson thesis and consider it as a valid theory regarding the origin of religion, then we also have to ask, well, how can religion be so wrong? That is a question that really comes up and cannot be avoided. I would just point out quite simply that, again, the difference between religious experience as a direct visionary contact with the divine. You see under the influence of these psychoactive plants who actually talk to you and speak to you, as you know, many people who've taken them will say that. The plant species actually enters your nervous system and uses your own brain to speak to you, to teach you things, to point out things. This is not some fantastic story I'm making up. It's very widely attested by indigenous peoples who use these plants. And even in the lore of European folklore, this is often attested. Sometimes in these woodcuts and these drawings you see from medieval herbals, which were widespread in Europe, you will see that plants are represented as people. A certain plant or a tree will be represented as a person because the plant spirit, the intelligence of that species, spoke to people at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about a primal revelation to the human species from the plant species. Don't forget that the plants are the most numerous inhabitants of this earth, not us.
Right. Hmm.
This planet is a plant planet. And there are more plant species and more plant entities on this planet than any other kind of species. And so the original experience that Watson pointed to can be called an interspecies communication. Certain plants have a psychoactive chemistry that allows them to open our minds and speak to us. Now, all of that existed before religion, and all of it also exists today completely apart from religion.
Yeah.
What happened when religion, that is to say, dogma, priests, and the organization of religion began was actually the repression and the forbidding of these plants.
Huh. Well, that's very interesting, and that's a good point, I think, because to me it feels like it has been kind of a restriction from the people at the top, the priest, archer, call them whatever you want, that they have been kind of put in a position where they solely have the access to these kinds of enlightening, substances, if you will, and the rest of the people has kind of been left, outside that circle, if you will.
Well, I don't know if they have the access to it. That's a good thing to debate about, and that's connected with the thesis of Karl Ruck, which I mentioned earlier. But one thing is certain. Just look at the story of Genesis in the Bible. Just look at the forbidden fruit. Gordon Wasson was very clear, and so were the other scholars who worked with him. Many high-level scholars and botanists were very clear on this point. The story of the forbidding of the fruit in the Garden of Eden is the story of how the early priesthoods forbade human beings in the tribe, in the community, to have this direct communication with the divine. It was the beginning of mind control. It was the beginning of everything that we see in our world today that prevents us as individuals from experiencing ecstasy and illumination firsthand. And so the control and suppression of these sacred plants is essential to the organized religions, absolutely essential. There is no organized religion, whether it be Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, which could continue to exist if the use of these psychoactive plants were widely permitted and done in an intelligent manner. So we're really looking at a battle here that has been going on for over 2,000 years, and in some respects, we are reaching the final phase of this battle right now, as we speak, as we have this interview.
Yeah. Continue.
You probably know about what happened in Holland this week.
No, enlighten me about that. What's happening?
Well, Holland has long been a place, you know, of liberal attitudes.
Right.
Not only concerning prostitution, but also concerning the sale and smoking of marijuana and hashish and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone who goes to Amsterdam or other places in Holland has seen the smart shops.
Yep.
Where you could buy, until 2 years ago, you could buy dried psychoactive mushrooms of various species, such as Psilocybe mexicana, Strophario cubensis, and so forth. Then, about 2 years ago, legislation was brought in to make the dried packets, the dried mushrooms, illegal, and they were classed, get this, they were classed at the same level as cocaine. So the possession of dried mushrooms is a Class A offense legally now in the European Union, and they're not sold anymore in Holland.
Really?
This was done, by the way, regardless of the fact that there is absolutely no scientific or medical evidence whatsoever that psychoactive mushrooms have any of the devastating effects of cocaine, nor are they addictive. Well, that happened about 2 years ago, and then I was saying to my friends, I'm afraid there's worse coming still. And the worst has now happened. It was possible to buy fresh mushrooms, to buy them in packages just like you would buy mushrooms in a grocery store.
Right, right.
Fresh psychoactive mushrooms in most of the smart shops in Holland. Just this month, they are putting a legislation into effect that makes it illegal to sell fresh mushrooms anymore in Holland.
So you can't even... because I know that many people have, for instance, they grow their own mushrooms, right? They buy these small little packages with the, you know, with the spores
in
them.
That's the next thing that's going to go, Henrik.
It is.
That's the next thing. Right now, they've taken two steps, and I fully believe that they will eventually take the third step, which will be that they will not only forbid the sale of what are called growth kits.
Yeah.
You know, growth kits can still be sold in Holland, and they can be ordered in various European countries by the mail. I believe that they're going to outlaw the sale of growth kits, and they're going to make it illegal for anyone to grow their own mushrooms.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I'm not surprised. This goes along, you know, in the same line, under the same umbrella of everything else that is going on today. We could, for example, mention Codex Alimentarius and even the C-51 legislation that is on in Canada right now. And basically, this is about big pharma criminalizing everything that has to do with natural, you know, health products, even up to, you know, garlic and bottled water, in fact. I mean, this is...
That's right.
It's insane.
That's right.
You know?
It's terribly frightening, this business about the Codex Alimentarius.
Yeah.
And I see that you had an interview regarding the esoteric agenda on your site.
Right, right, yeah.
I haven't had a chance to look at that yet, but I've been saying to my friends, and I've been putting out the message on my site, that there is absolutely no difference between the great program of Codex Alimentarius, that is to control the food supply of the world, and the control of these psychoactive substances. Both of those programs are coming from the same source.
Yeah.
And we are very, very close to an extremely dangerous situation. I think that Esoteric Agenda is a terribly frightening film.
Yeah.
It scared me, I can tell you that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's a wake-up call. That's what the point of it is, in a way. I mean, people gotta realize this, that as you say, I mean, you mentioned it yourself, John, that this is a battle, in a way, and unfortunately, as things are right now, you know, we're not winning that battle, so to speak, because we're not even aware of what's going on, you know?
Well, we're becoming aware of what's going on very, very rapidly through the internet and through specifically the kind of work that you do at Red Ice Creations, the kind of really serious detective work of exposing this madness that's taking place.
Yeah.
But I think that people will need to look very carefully at how they're going to survive in the future. And what I would propose is that, to do everything that we can to make people aware that this war, there is a war against humanity taking place, and it's taking place on two fronts. One is a war against nutrition, against our ability to feed ourselves. And, of course, that's enough to alarm any ordinary person.
Indeed.
But the second is, let's not forget that at the same time, there is a spiritual dimension, because there is a war against the freedom of your mind, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's the psychoactive plants, the plant teachers, which are called the sacred medicine plants, that give us freedom of our minds and put us directly in contact with the divinity of nature and the voice of nature. It's these plants, while you can say potatoes and apples and zucchini and garlic keep us alive and keep us healthy, you could say that the sacred medicine plants keep us sane. They keep us sane, and they maintain our relationship to Gaia and to direct contact from the divine. There is no human being on this planet who needs another person to stand between them and the divinity or the Godhead.
Right.
In fact, it should be absolutely forbidden. If this were a sane planet that was run by compassion and run by intelligent people, it would be forbidden for any person to put themselves between another person and God.
Yeah, yeah.
And so by taking away, I mean, it's frightening what is happening to the food situation. You know, after I saw Esoteric Agenda, I said to myself, well, even if you can't swallow the notion that these great pharmacological programs are orchestrated to create famine and poison the world, that is in fact what they're going to do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whether it's an orchestrated agenda or not, that is in fact what they're going to do. So it's terribly frightening, and we must somehow, I think, not let a day go by when we don't think about these problems and try to understand the individual responsibility in facing this here. I mean, we're really coming down to the showdown here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we also have to point out, of course, that it's only also when we put ourselves in the hands of these, you know, multinational pharmaceutical corporations that we're are becoming slaves, so to speak, to them. I mean, because still there's nothing at this point, at least, and that might change tomorrow, but today at least there's nothing they can do to ban nature, as they can't go out and you know, prevent, for instance, psilocybin mushrooms to grow in the forest. I mean, this is still accessible if you go out into nature itself. So, I mean, it's still there, and how much they even decide to ban it on their level, we still can attain it. The same thing goes for food, of course. I mean, we can still be in a position, if we own a little piece of land, where we still can grow some of these things, and albeit that they might, you know, make this illegal and so forth, but that's civil disobedience right there, where you actually do the things that you believe to be right, and if you know, push comes to shove, you might be arrested because of that or whatever. But this is an important thing to kind of put your foot down in the ground, so to speak, and say, this is where I draw the line. You know, I don't care what kind of laws they set up, because I morally think that I'm in the right to do this, and that's what I'm going to do. That's how I feel about it, anyway.
Well, I agree with you, and I think more and more people who are made aware of the situation by interviews like we're doing here, and of course many, many other sources on the internet, are feeling the same way. I mean, this is where we have to draw the line. We have to draw the line with food and with the sacred plants, both. They both go together. I think it's a very important point that I'm trying to make. You know, on MetaHistory.org, I have a new section now called Psychonauts. And there's a button on the menu bar that says Psychonauts up at the top.
Mm.
And there I'm discussing the Wasson thesis. And I'm discussing the generations, the three generations of people who have been experimenting with these not only LSD and mescaline and chemicals, but also with the sacred mushrooms. And one of the points that I make on there is that whoever may be listening to this interview, you know, it's not a question of whether or not you want to take psychoactive mushrooms. I'm not saying that everyone in the world has to take them.
Right, right.
I'm just saying that it's extremely important to be aware of what they are and to be aware of our right to take them if we want to.
Yeah.
And that is just as important for our survival as our right to eat the kind of food we want to eat.
Mm, indeed. And in your series there that you mentioned, do you go into anything at all in regards to how also many of these substances, and this is how I feel at least, that they've been kind of synthesized, meaning that they've taken certain, they've learned a little bit from how nature does it, so to speak, and then they've emulated this and slightly transformed it. If we talk about Sandoz, for instance, that corporation, I think actually they were one of the first corporations who were behind some of the SSRIs, so the antidepressants, and they actually learned from some of the things that Hoffman, synthesized. Do you know about that at all?
Yes, that's absolutely true. As a matter of fact, the designer drugs now that are used for depression, starting with Prozac and many others since then, Wellbutrin and Prozac, I don't know what their names are in Sweden, but they have been designed by chemists who have studied the psychopharmacology of the sacred plants. And it's a little bit of a black magic operating here, Hendrik, I think.
Yeah.
Because, what they're doing is, instead of saying, well, listen, all the cures for human ills, for neurosis, for depression and everything, are already out there in nature, why don't we just teach people to go find those plants and use them correctly? No, they're saying, we want to make big business out of it.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And so it's really quite perverse, but you are absolutely right. They work very closely with these traditional plant medicines. And in fact, Monsanto, for example, the great pharmaceutical company, have agents in the Amazon who collect hundreds of plants each week that have been used for thousands of years by the natives,
yeah,
and send them back to the Monsanto laboratories. And it's really very, very sick for them to do this, because they're not only stealing from the people of that region, but they're taking something that nature already gives us and not letting us know about it in its original form, and then they're going to turn around and make it into a pill and sell it to us, you know?
Indeed.
It's very, very sick. It's really a kind of black magic. And it's largely responsible for how sick and crazy and addictive our society is.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Now, and I think, I can't remember where I picked this up, but I think pharmacopoeia or even pharmacy actually has the roots in sorcery, I think the word even. But anyway.
That's right.
Yeah, I think
that's
so.
That's right,
so,
it does.
I mean, they don't,
yeah,
pick their words for no reason, you know. So
it is kind of a black magical battle that we're having here on Earth, and I'm starting to write about this now on a new section that I've created on MetaHistory.org called Right Action.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as we come toward this 2012 date, it will become more clear, and we're getting very, very close, you know, it's only,
yeah,
like 4 years away.
Right.
I think it will become clear that we're kind of like on a planet that is in the grip of black magic, of black magicians. You can think of some of these people who are intentionally deceiving the world and putting these programs like the Codex Alimentarius into action. It is a kind of a black magic, and so my suggestion would be that we would all have to become, in a sense, magicians in order to fight their magic with our magic.
Yeah.
And I can actually see it developing in that way, you know.
Hmm. Very interesting. And worth mentioning here again, because you popped the M word, Monsanto, right there, and it's
right.
It's worth mentioning also that, I mean, they are behind the Terminator seed technology, and as you say, they go around, take various seeds with big genetic diversity from around the globe. We can even look at what's going on with the global seed vault up in Svalbard right now. I mean,
mm-hmm,
what the heck is that all about? You know, they're consciously saving, you know, all of these different seeds with genetic diversity. I mean, even if this is not a big conspiracy behind it, it still kind of sends out the message that, okay, wait a minute here, you know, something is going on. We better protect, you know, the original seeds here and put them away in case something happens. Because in a way, if Monsanto's technology, you know, become, you know, more and more widely available, more corporations adopt their kind of methodology, what we could end up here is basically that we end up with genetically modified plants that actually are basically exterminating all the other, you know, plants in their neighborhood and so forth. This has happened with farmers like Percy Schmeisser, for instance. He got the you know, sense of that.
That's right.
How, you know, I think it was canola or something, or may have been corn, I'm not sure. that actually basically took over all of his field, and in the end he had to pay out to Monsanto because they said, you know, you are using our copyrighted plant right now, so you need to pay us, you know, the interest for that or whatever.
And that's right.
And it's insane, you know, in the
it's
end.
It's really
the
insane. It's a total control system.
Yeah.
And you know, in a way, I'd like to try to link this problem. I mean, more and more people are becoming aware of this because we've heard about this. This arc of seeds, and we hear more and more about Monsanto and these genetically modified plants each day. And I'd like to try to make a link here in the listener's mind between these developments and something that happened many thousands of years ago when the religion was founded as such.
Mm.
Remember that I said that Wasson and the scholars around him were quite convinced that the story of the Garden of Eden was about the forbidding of psychoactive plants.
Mm.
The taboo on psychoactive plants began a long time ago in order to control the community. Because, see, religion controls people by beliefs and by rituals, whereas the ingestion of these psychoactive plants actually liberates people.
Yeah.
It liberates their minds, it refreshes and regenerates them, it heals them, and it gives them, each individual, the opportunity to experience the planet and the divinity of the world we live in our own individual way. And once you have experienced that divinity, once you have had an illumination and a visionary experience with these plants, no one can ever take that away from you, and no one can ever fool you with any kind of religious doctrines or beliefs.
Yeah.
So I think it's clear that in order for religion to be created as a control system, a social control system, access to these psychoactive plants had to be forbidden. I think that's fairly easy to understand.
Hmm.
Am I making that clear?
Mm, I definitely follow you there. And I mean, what is interesting here is also, again, and we haven't really spent any time on this, so maybe we can dive into it, the fact that what is happening is that we're tapping into something when we access these plants or mushrooms or whatever we want to talk about here, that, you know, the question that arises is are we tapping into parts of our own unconscious, if you will, because of the fact that these plants are they have these active, psychoactive substances, meaning that we're actually accessing something within ourselves. Or is there really something going on more beyond that, meaning that there actually is a communication between ourselves and something else? Or is this simply actually an interface between ourselves and Gaia or Mother Earth, as you said? What do you think about that, John?
I strongly argue, as you know, in all through my site, that these plants are not merely chemicals that enter our mind and allow us to access our own subconscious or unconscious. Not at all. We are actually communicating with another species when we ingest these plants. And these sacred medicine plants, such as peyote, ayahuasca, the psilocybin mushroom, iboga, they all have specific properties. Why? Because they are all specific entities. They are all teachers. They are called plant teachers, plant allies. And there are two levels, or three levels, I would say, of this visionary experience with plants. And I'm speaking now not only from my own personal experience, but from what I have read of others. The first level is you ingest, say, a Stropharia cubensis mushroom, and that mushroom, the chemistry of that mushroom, changes your neural system, and you first learn to the mushroom itself. The mushroom itself shows you its particular knowledge.
Hmm.
Just like mescalito in the tales of Don Juan and Castaneda, the mescal plant, the cactus plant, peyote, shows its particular knowledge to those who ingest it. That's the first level.
Hmm.
The second level is that the plant entity is an intermediary and takes you to the Gaian intelligence. So at the second stage, the visionary plant experience goes right into the intelligence of the entire planet itself. You're hooked in to the planetary mind itself. And Terence, of course, wrote very beautifully about this.
Mm.
The third level, then, is once you become in contact with the planetary mind or Gaia, well, that Gaia is a divine planetary entity. She's a super organism, and she herself is in touch with the entire cosmos. That is to say, the sun, the moon, the stars, and other planets.
Right.
So the third step of the visionary experience would be to take you through the Gaian intelligence into the entire intelligence of the cosmos, of the galaxy. And those three levels are very real. They can be distinguished, and you can journey through those levels very consciously and reach each level and communicate and learn different things at each level. So this is and always has been the primary religious experience of humanity. Now, what I would like to point out is something that perhaps we haven't touched on yet in this conversation. So I consider it to be extremely important in facing the danger of our time. If we can accept that some people want to control this experience, they want to forbid it to the community, because that's what we are, we're the community of people living on Earth, the human community. They want to forbid it to the human community so that they can control and manipulate the human community for their own purposes, okay?
Right.
Now, you mentioned earlier something that Professor Karl Rupp has also proposed. He proposed that the Judeo-Christian priesthood, for example, who forbade the psychoactive plant, actually kept it for their own use.
Right.
And this is a theory that has been going around a bit now, and lately there's been a lot of discussion around this guy, Benny Shannon,
who's been
saying, oh yes, well, even Moses, who produced the Ten Commandments and so forth, well, he was secretly using some kind of psychoactive plant and so forth. So there is a theory, there is a scenario that says, listen very closely because this is extremely important, that those who are forbidding the psychoactive plants to others are actually using it themselves. Okay? Now, I want to say very clearly why I believe that that scenario is wrong. I believe that scenario is completely wrong, and I believe that there's a flaw in that scenario. And I'll tell you simply why I reject that scenario. Because the priesthood who forbids this psychoactive vision to the human community are themselves afraid of that vision. They are not forbidding it to others and then hoarding it and keeping it to themselves. They are actually afraid of it. And they are afraid of others having it, and they are afraid of also having it themselves. So Karl Rupp's theory that the church hierarchy, for instance, of the Catholic Church, has always used Amanita muscaria mushroom in a secret ceremony behind the scenes of the Vatican, whatever, I can't buy that.
Right, right.
Because my understanding, and this is so important, what I want to say now, is that fear of nature is what is driving these black magicians. They're afraid of nature.
Yeah.
Fear of nature is what is driving the people of Monsanto to create archontic simulations of nature.
You're right.
And you know, Heinrich, we've talked about the subject of the Melchizedek complex.
Yeah.
It came up in another conversation we had, and I think it's come up in several of your investigations, that the idea of genomics and immortalism, the Grail Quest, if you want to call it that,
right,
is rooted in the Old Testament
and
in the figure of Melchizedek. I equate it with the figure of Melchizedek rather than the figure of Methuselah.
Right, right.
Well, this is the comment that I would make about that. Those human beings who are allowed to have a direct visionary experience of nature through these sublime plants experience immortality. Therefore, they don't need to seek it.
They've already found it.
They have already found it. And they experience immortality. I can say it myself. I have experienced immortality. Not in the sense that the body that is standing here talking to you on the telephone is going to live forever.
Yeah.
But in the sense that my consciousness is part of a living body of this planet that will continue for thousands and millions of years. And so I have experienced the immortality of the Earth, and I am a cell that will be constantly reborn in one form or another in that living organism. Now, anyone who has had that experience, and it's not an uncommon thing, many people read many reports in these books of people who have taken ayahuasca or magic mushrooms. Anyone who has had that experience is not going to be going on a quest for one immortal physical body.
Hmm.
The motivation, do you know what the motivation of that quest is? Fear of death.
There you go, exactly, yeah.
And when you take this, when you enter this visionary trance, when you allow your ego to die and melt, and you become like a tree, like a stone, like an animal, like a fly, like a star, you become momentarily part of all that lives, and all that lives in you, the fear of death is absolutely taken away from you.
Hmm.
And it's inconceivable that you would then turn around and go on this ridiculous quest to create a physical instrument that would live forever.
Hmm.
And so that's the real battle. That is really the spiritual insanity behind genomics and immortality. It's a fear of death.
Hmm. Well, I agree.
So I believe that those people who fear death also fear the visionary experience, because you have to go through a kind of death in order to have that experience, as everyone knows.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's very interesting. So to kind of tie this back around together again, what you're saying here also is that if it was true that these people were secretly behind the scenes dealing with these kinds of substances, we would not have a world that looks like it looks like today, because they from that experience would have learned much of these things that we have talked about during this program here, and also consequently then not have this fear of death and not would have this kind of drive to control everything and restrict everything. That is what you're saying here, right?
That is exactly what I'm saying. And that is why I personally, I mean, I don't have any proof. I can't prove that, you know, there aren't Jesuits or there aren't people at the Vatican who, you know, do secret ceremonies with psychoactive plants. I can't prove that. I can't have no physical evidence. But it seems totally illogical to me that anyone, well, let me speak for myself.
Mm.
I myself and the hundreds of people that I have met who have ingested psychoactive mushrooms or even taken LSD for that matter, have never occurred to us to control the experience of another person.
Yeah.
It's just completely antithetical to the nature of that experience.
Yeah.
So I reject that theory, and I strongly suggest that we consider that the people who are turning the world into a simulated nightmare with all this archontic stuff they're doing are people who are afraid of nature, they're afraid of their own bodies, they're afraid of their own organisms.
Hmm.
And unfortunately, my friend, fear is a very powerful motivator.
Indeed, indeed.
So unless we can be motivated by love and inspiration more than they are motivated by fear, our chances of winning this struggle are not going to be so good.
I mean, it's logical what you're saying there, because again, if we look at the fruits of what they are doing, I mean, it has been a suppression of the feminine and even the female in many cases. It's everything that you know has to do with the life-giving force here. I mean, nature is not something that can be controlled, and for that reason, I think that these people are also afraid of that. Then, as a consequence, Monsanto, if we look at what they're doing, I mean, if we really kind of make this as simple as possible, what they're doing is they're trying to control nature. They're trying to, with the Terminator seed technology, all of this is about control, and everything that is not controllable, they're afraid of it and consequently want to ban that or outlaw it, whatever, you know.
Exactly. You showed it very well in your film On the Grail when you pointed out the resemblance of the sign Aries to the ovaries.
Right, right.
And you pointed out that, cloning is not a glorification of human intelligence. It's not a step that humanity reaches where we become like gods and we're able to create. Cloning is a reaction of fear.
Yeah.
It's a reaction of fear and ignorance. Anyone who would want to clone anything must be afraid and ignorant of the natural processes of reproduction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And so there is a great deal of fear. The people who are now, you know, we're facing a very, very big shutdown. And I say again, you know, I don't advocate that everyone in the human community take psychoactive mushrooms. It may not be for everyone, but I certainly advocate that they respect those who do take them,
mm-hmm.
and that they respect the right of every single person to make that choice to take them or not take them,
yeah.
just like you have the right to, you know, to make the choice if you want to eat potatoes. But, you know, that choice to eat potatoes is going to be taken away from you, and you're going to have to eat synthetic potatoes.
Yeah.
So we are coming very close to a real showdown here. I don't know what form it's going to take, but it's intense.
It is. I mean, again, it's worth mentioning that as things are laid out right now, at least, Codex Alimentarius is planned to go in, I think, December 31st, 2009.
That's right.
And this has been going on since basically the 60s, 70s, and we have not heard that much about it until just a few years ago. It's started,
just a few years ago. It's
yeah.
finally coming in next year, 2009. It comes into its all of its programs are supposed to be implemented, and that is very, very frightening. Well, when I heard that, I got my blood went cold.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a frightening piece of information. Yet I think at the same time, we really have enough networking power at our hands right now with the internet and with the kind of things that you're doing. We have enough networking power to make people aware of what is being done to them. You know,
yeah.
I personally don't believe that this can be pulled off unless people are blind.
Exactly.
Yeah, as long as people are deceived and blind, they have a good chance of succeeding. But as the more people know what the agenda is, the less chance they have of succeeding.
Exactly. And worth mentioning also is that, I mean, in many cases, unfortunately, man has to learn, man and, you know, humanity, so to speak, has to learn the hard way. And we have to, you know, actually potentially go into a period where they actually, you know, enforce this in some way. And a consequence of that might be that we, you know, revolt against this in one way or another. And it's never, I mean, it's never too late to turn back to that. I mean, again, we know that they're saving seeds up at Svalbard right now. So we know that there still is, you know, it's hope, you know, that's what I want to say, at least. It's still hope, although they will never succeed in banning nature. Nature will always find a way to creep in and, you know, succeed over all of this. That's how I feel.
Yes, they will never overcome nature, but it's important to bear in mind that they think they can. And when you're dealing with people who are insane, and I believe this is really the case, that I believe that many of the people who are implementing these programs and who have conceived these programs are really insane. They have really lost their minds, and they're living in a state of fear.
Yeah.
It's good to know that that you're dealing with somebody that's insane, and we have to take extreme measures
exactly
against such people.
Yeah. Hmm. And you know, a finishing question or comment here before we round things up with the first segment here. You mentioned also about, you know, that they're insane, and you mentioned sanity. And do you think that because of our disconnection to nature, this is what slowly have kind of been evolving and growing up to the point where we are today, where we're, you know, have people in power that are totally, you know, as you say, they're insane, basically. They want to control everything. But do you think that has its roots in the fact that we've more and more been disconnected from everything that is natural? Do you think that's the case?
Well, I think it's a direct consequence of the taboo which is told in the story of Genesis. And I think, as you know, I wrote my book, Not in His Image, against religion, because I think that religion has been, especially Judeo-Christian religion in the West, has been the main instrument in bringing us to this point. Yes, if we live on a planet that is alive and intelligent and mostly populated by plants, and we depend on those plants, you know, to eat and to survive and to live, then I think it's easy to see that we could also depend on those plants to keep our intelligence attuned to the planet itself. Mm. And by taking away that attunement and that connection, and by denying it, the human species was put on a course of self-destruction, which we are now coming to the end of.
Mm. Full circle. Mm. Very interesting. John, we're going to continue talking a little bit more about the members section. We're going to talk more about Edwin Salter, of a very interesting discovery that you have made, and I'm looking forward very much going into this, because it's a fascinating subject. So stay tuned, members. A lot more is coming. But John, tell us a little bit about some of the books that you have out there for us, and also about your website before we round things off here in the first segment.
Well, primarily my book, Not in His Image, is the one that would speak most to the subjects we've talked about today, because it deals with two things. One, the origins of religion, and the glorification of suffering. That is one of the tools religion uses to control people, you know, to justify suffering, to convince people that it's good for them to suffer, and that God wants them to suffer, and that suffering has a redemptive value. So as you know, I've attacked this very strongly in my book, Not in His Image, and I've also talked about the use of sacred plants in the pre-Christian and pre-Judaic mysteries of Europe. So that's still pretty much my most important message. And then, of course, on metahistory.org, my site, those who want to follow this conversation should go to the menu bar and click on Psychonautics. And there they'll see a picture of Maria Sabina, of Joanna Harcourt Smith, and of a mushroom entity. And they will get an explanation of the whole Wasson thesis from the very beginnings in the 1930s up until 1965, when 66, when LSD was banned. And so I'm trying to just give that background, because I think that story is very helpful for us to see what we're up against today.
Very good. The website's, again, metahistory.org, and also check out futureprimitive.org, the accompanying website to that. Thank you very much for this segment, John, and stay with us, and we'll talk more after the break.
Great. Thank you.